Welcome back to FinTalk, brought to you by Vermo. Here we discuss pressing topics in fintech, regtech, covering regulatory, collateral and digital across banking and insurance and finance. Vermo has been proud to deliver innovative software solutions in the industry with stability and cost efficiency for our global roster of clients. With over 20 years of trusted transformation in finance and insurance, we're bringing industry's top expertise to FinTalk. I'm Gerald Akhtar and I'll be your host for this podcast. Welcome back to FinTalk, brought to you by Vermic. I'm Gerald Akhtar, your host for today. So today we're going to be talking about how we can efficiently reuse RegTech. Today I'm delighted to have Neeraj Raja, who is the Managing Director, Head of Data, RegTech and Digital Advisory Practice from GT. Neeraj, I'll let you introduce yourself and talk a bit more, but my second guest here is obviously someone that's coming back, Alan Blanchard, but this time in a Vermic suit as head of partnerships. So welcome both to Alan and Neeraj. And Neeraj, if I can ask you to say a few words and then we'll pass over to Alan.
Sure, of course. Do you actually issue Vermic suits when you come back? Is that how it works? If Alan has one, I'd be quite delighted. But thank you very much for having me. I'm Neeraj Raja. I lead the Data, RegTech and Digital Advisory Practice at Grant Thornton. Grant Thornton is obviously one of the big professional services firm across advisory, tax, corporate finance, etc. And my role at Grant Thornton is to actually lead advisory, assurance and implementation for a range of our financial services and large corporate clients, working across banking, insurance, asset management, capital markets, etc. And we do a lot of work within a lot of the RegTech industry and helping organizations really get better value out of their regulatory compliance through automation and data and the use of RegTech, which I think we're going to talk a lot about.
Perfect. Thanks, Neeraj. Alan, welcome back.
Thanks, Jared. Yes, hi, everyone. Alan Blanchard here. So as Jared said, I joined Vermeg at the start of October 2022, so about a month ago at the time of recording, joining to head up the partnerships work. So Vermeg's range of software is really prime for partnering with other solutions providers, technology consultants to really look at solving, well, in Vermeg's case, some of the biggest problems in banking, capital markets and insurance when it comes to working as efficiently as possible. Before that, I worked for a Swiss RegTech, as any listeners to previous podcasts will know, solving problems around cross-border compliance. And before that, I worked at the FCA, where I really got to know what RegTech is, working on the digital handbook, digital rules as code, automatic compliance, that sort of stuff. So that's really where I got to know most of the names and faces that are involved in RegTech as we stand now.
Excellent. Thank you both. And welcome. And I know how busy you are, so I appreciate your time here. So I want to dive straight into this. Neeraj did a paper for Grant Thornton around RegTech 2.0. So some really interesting points that came out of that. And there's one that I wanted to start with. So you guys made a statement about 50 to 70% of a firm's annual change budget is spent on reg change. So how can firms use RegTech efficiently to reduce the cost and provide added value? I think the biggest issue in the market has always been about reg is just the cost, right? How can we actually turn that around and show the value, the key value to RegTech?
Perfect. Thank you, John. I think we probably start with the most difficult question, I think, to start with. Thank you for that. So look, I think just a bit more in terms of my experience, before Grant Thornton was working for two of the biggest universal banks, Barclays and also Lloyds Banking Group, and spent about 15 to 20 years in financial services across a variety of activity. And what I've seen over my career across financial services, across those large banks, and now working with banks, insurers and asset managers, is the regulatory portfolio or the cost of regulation, cost to do business is high because financial services are a very highly regulated sector. And as a consequence, we have a huge amount of regulation which actually focuses on conduct, prudential, financial crime. There's a variety of regulations. And so every organization, if you look at the cost, they actually tend to spend quite a huge amount of those of their budgets on regulation and regulatory and staying on top of regulation. How then do the regulatory technology or RegTech actually solve the problem? It's you try what fundamentally you could do with RegTech is through automation and data. So RegTech, you know, in terms of that technology, is driven and powered by automation and data. That's how RegTechs generally work. Is really to reduce and eliminate the cost savings come from three or four factors. The first is you actually reduce the manual work, i.e. the work in terms of people doing on certain activity across the compliance lifecycle or the regulatory lifecycle in various format. And you take some of the volume of manual work away and you make that automated, where a software and platform and technology does the work. Simple example is horizon scanning. Or horizon management, where you're scanning new regulations. I've seen teams of 6 to 10 people going through scanning and evaluating multiple websites and pulling data together and pulling formulations together, what regulations are coming. There are fantastic regulatory horizon management software out there which can do that in minutes on a daily basis without 10 people or 6 to 10 people having to do that across multiple jurisdictions, multiple regulators, etc. So first part of that is the actual manual activity taken away in terms of cost. The second is actually through the regulatory change execution, you have multiple volume of change which is coming through. And again, by having clever workflow, governance, risk and compliance tooling, auditability, traceability, by applying really good applications, data and regulatory technology, the actual cost of regulatory change itself in terms of managing the regulation that comes across, you can take that away in terms of the actual execution of regulation, regulatory change by change teams, if you do that properly using data and technology. So that's the second driver of taking cost out of that. The third driver really is remediation cost. So when we talk about the 50 to 70% cost is how much of that cost comes through from actually having to redo regulatory change and undertake further activity, more expensive activity, because you've not got it right first time because of sustainability. And technology and regulatory technology really helps you, if done properly, achieve sustainable compliance, you know, on an ongoing basis and auditable compliance. So you don't need to redo regulatory changes and you're not hit with Section 166s and regulatory censor. So I hope that helps to answer that question in terms of how regulatory technology, RegTech, can really start to take cost out of delivering regulation, but also leave an organization with sustainable compliance.
Yeah, there's quite a lot there that I know I'll definitely would look to talk about more in more detail, actually, some key points that you picked up. Alan, from your experience, how do you see that?
Yes, obviously, a very, very good summary by Naresh there on the kind of three main drivers as to why RegTech exists in the first place. And I think if it wasn't solving those problems, it would struggle to have a justification. But fortunately, it does deliver on all three of those aspects, which is good. But I think it's not without its challenges. So what I've seen selling a variety of kind of RegTech solutions and building them as well, is that you're always challenging the status quo, really, as your biggest competitor as a RegTech vendor, which is usually a spreadsheet of some description. And this is seen as a kind of low risk and doesn't require a huge, great set of skills to kind of manage this newfangled contraption that you've brought in. So I think RegTech carries with it this perception that it's risky. These technologies are risky. They're not 100%. The margin for error can be too great for the risk appetite for the firm involved. And then you require those, you know, those 6 to 10 people may no longer be required to do the manual tasks, but they may be required to change their skill sets to manage these technologies that now do this thing to make sure it's done correctly, that it's right first time. So that there's this kind of skills transformation as well. But I think the opposite of that argument, I think it is on that if you keep things the same, if you maintain the status quo, all that money that you're spending on these manual processes is dead money. It's dead spend. You don't achieve anything really from spending the money other than ticking a box when it comes to talking to a regulator or satisfying yourself that you've acted in a compliant way from an audit point of view or whatever. If you pull in these RegTech solutions, you are now able to leverage that technology in other ways. So it's not just a horizon scanning tool. It can transform that regulatory content into data. That data can be used in a different process, in a different location, to produce a different result. So you're now starting to look at a digital first approach to compliance. So In addition to these kind of basic cost savings measures, there's also this functionality benefit that you get off the back of that, where you're managing to put all of this content into a data store or format, and then this data can be leveraged in other ways to drive other cost savings and other efficiencies throughout that kind of compliance process.
Thank you, Alan. So there were some key points. I think it was echoed from both parts from Nirish and Alan that in my day-to-day, we talk to a lot of firms, a lot of clients about, you know, what do we do, right? And with the threat of the Section 166, banks tend to become reactionary rather than proactive. So kind of moving down to that, you know, let's not be reactionary, let's not wait for the Section 166, you know, what do we need to do? So, you know, how can firms kind of move to a model where they maximize the full benefits of a RegTech solution and software, or what are the key changes that need to happen? Is it a case of, you know, we just throw loads of money, get loads of reg people, loads of data people, and suddenly it's going to work, right? So, what advice would you give, you know, from a Grafforton point of view, and Alan from a Vermic point of view?
Sure, thank you. Look, we've been working with about 20 clients in the space over the last 2 years. So that has given us an anonymized view of what works really well in terms of the scenario, and actually sometimes what doesn't work well. And from my previous experience, both at Barclays and Lloyds, I probably learned as much of what didn't work well and lessons learned as what did work well. This, and apologies to my former two organizations, where you learn a lot by failure sometimes. But you know, fundamentally, what I think there are two or three things that firms can move to a model. The first is, and I talk about this in the RegTech 2.0 paper, Jared, as you know, is I think there needs to be a RegTech strategy. So an organization, you know, has to be issue led. And what that means is don't get bamboozled by the fantastic UX and UI and whizzy dashboards that RegTech software firms can sometimes provide, but there is no substance underneath it. It doesn't actually execute. So the key part is, one needs to have a RegTech strategy, which is focused on issue. So if you have an issue, which is you really want to get better viewpoints of your regulations and your controls, is to have the right key components in place in terms of regulation and controls, is that's your issue. You need to link your controls to new regulations, or you have a horizon management problem, or you have a financial crime problem, or whatever it might be. So be issue-led. And then is to look at really creating a RegTech strategy that delivers on that. And being really ruthless about what that RegTech strategy is going to articulate, and be issue-led, not solution-driven in terms of the software. Then you need to go through a process, I think, in terms of, we call it the RegTech enablement model, is you basically think about a life cycle of, here are the regulatory issues, look, we've understood that, you need to document that, the requirements, the scope, all of those activities really, really clearly. The second is then, do an evaluation search of RegTech software. And there are plenty out there. You know, there are 200 in the UK RegTech firms, maybe 400 odd in Europe that we are tracking. And we need to do a really thorough evaluation, selection, and due diligence to work out which are the best RegTech firms for that specific issue. Here's something then we also created, is a RegTech taxonomy, which are the 15 different use cases of RegTech, from horizon management to digital identity, and we'll add a 16th module, which is in terms of actually the ESG, which I think will take a new one that's coming in. But fundamentally, there are certain firms which are very good at horizon management. There are certain firms at combating financial crime in terms of RegTech software, certain firms at transaction monitoring. Not all the RegTech firms can do all of those. So being really clear in terms of the evaluation and selection, due diligence, and then selection of that. And then you need to implement, obviously, really clear in terms of interoperability with the existing systems, integration with your existing architecture, in terms of the RegTech software, and making sure the UX, UI, usability all works. That's the kind of common bit. Coupled with that, as part of the RegTech and O model, this is where it comes to change that happens, where there is benefits being driven, to your question, is you've got to change the framework, the operating model, the process, procedures, train people, the governance and accountability, et cetera. And that needs to go very much hand in hand with the software. So without that framework and operating model change and training and so on, you're not going to get the benefits that you want from getting these software in. So I think those are the key points I would make, is one, be really issue-led, have a RegTech strategy once you've documented the issue, have an enabled model of how you're going to identify requirements, issue, and you know, evaluate, search and select, execute, bring that together, coupled with operating model change, roles and responsibilities, training, etc., and then be really ruthless around that, pulling all of that together.
That sounds a logical way of doing things, right? It's it does make sense. Alan, your input?
Yeah, I mean, Nimesh has summed it very nicely there. It sounds like an awful lot of change to me. I mean, that's a huge amount of work that needs to go into what should be a fairly no-brainer decision in terms of that finding that issue and finding the solution. But this is why it's not the place of a software vendor or a RegTech solution to do all of that ancillary work around the list that Naresh just put in there about all those changes that are required to make this happen. It's got to be done in partnership with ideally a consultancy or a system integrator who knows that business very well, has worked with that business for a long time, and can match very nicely the relevant technology to the relevant issue and join them together as well. Because as Naresh rightly says, there's no one solution that solves for everything in this space, but we are all willing to work together and connect solutions together so that we can present hopefully an end-to-end solution for any particular problem that exists. We realize that these problems are huge and the effort required to solve them is massive and takes more than one person or institution or firm. But this is why you get these marketplaces, why I think you're getting these reg techs coalescing around these marketplaces that some of the bigger solutions providers are putting together, because we well understand that we need to plug into other different systems to be able to attack some of this. I think when it comes to the issue side of things, I think it's sometimes very, very difficult for a firm to understand that they actually have an issue, because the ways of working are so ingrained. And the example that I've used time and again, I hope I didn't use this on the last podcast, but is when we had road atlases printed out in our car and no one really had a problem with it, because you'd have someone sat next to you telling you which way to go, you'd ignore them, you'd get lost, you didn't know what road you were on, right? I mean, this is a manual process, paper-based, analog system, but your objective is to get from A to B as efficiently as possible. And the only tool that you have is the paper atlas, right? So little did we know that once we got a mobile phone, we could put the maps in the phone. The phone knew where we were. It could program us from A to B much more efficiently. So there's sort of still this other piece of education, particularly around RegTech, to understand these issues, understand that they are a problem, that they are dragging you down, they are costing you a lot of money, despite, you know, all these regulatory projects that come through, huge, great things, spending millions of pounds on solving them, still doing it the same old way. So we still haven't quite mastered that issue awareness, that education piece, to identify that actually you're working from a road atlas in a car when you could be plugging in a sat nav. So I think that's still some of the effort that hopefully Naresh is going to solve for everyone.
Yeah, old-fashioned paper atlas. I think I'm sure loads of people have still got those in their cars. I guarantee go back to my AA roadmap of the UK. Some question I get a lot, and we get from a Vermec point of view, from a professional service point of view, and when we talk to clients, is there's just so much change. I know Naresh, you picked up on the horizon scanning, because that's a really topical point at the moment. I know this year, every client I've spoken to, it's about, you know, how do we horizon scan? There's so much, right? There's the EBA, there's the EBA rule book, there's the UK version of it, then you've got CPs on top of that. You know, you think you're on top of it, and then suddenly the CP comes in, or there's a policy statement from the regulator about this certain section. And firms always find that they're kind of chasing their tail. So, you know, with all that and the kind of ever-evolving regulatory landscape, I know you touched upon horizon scanning, and that's one way of, you know, kind of keeping it, but there is so much change. And especially with the onboarding of the UK regulation, how can firms? I mean, firms are not. It'd be great to have an army of people, you know, looking at everything. And yes, there are softwares out there that can, you know, provide that. And, you know, I've seen from your RegTech paper, you know, what's your advice to them?
I think there's really two things. We've been helping a large insurer and also a large universal bank. You know, two of them are the same, but two projects are running at the same time, and we've been helping and helped them solve this very issue. And I think the issue is twofold. One is, how do you actually have a really clear understanding of which rules, regulations, policies, guidance you need to comply with? And you should have been complying with historically anyway, based on that, you know, based on your regulatory permissions, your licenses, your customer group, your products, your services, your extraterritorial nexus obligations, your operations globally, etc. Right. So what we call is a regulatory universe is the first of all is to map which regulations should you have been in compliance with anyway. Hopefully you've not missed anything. But also in terms of future regulations, what is an easy way to catch those based on, as I said, your regulatory permissions, the regulators that you have licenses with, your customers and clients, and therefore how that will bring conduct rules and different type of conduct rules depending on the customer set, the products that you have that come to different types of product sets that you will bring in different regulations, jurisdictions you operate, jurisdictions you interoperate with, etc. So we build a regulatory library called our universe to be able to scope what's in scope, out of scope really clearly. And we've done that with both these organizations simultaneously. That gives a really clear view for the first line and the second line of, if there is a future type of regulation coming up, it's very easy to identify which part of the business and are you in scope based on those different categories. Okay, so hopefully that helps in terms of map back historically, you've not missed anything. And also future, it gets a real clear taxonomy and description and documentation of what can come in the future that you're able to catch easily. The second part then is, for me, is it does come down to a really good horizon management tool set, which then can be customized to be able to scan new regulations. There is no way that through just human intervention, one's going to do this. And having an army of people, it just doesn't make sense to be able to catch all these regulations and work them through. So, and this is where, coming back to some of the earlier examples I gave, in terms of our horizon management tools, you've got to actually make sure you evaluate them with a really set of clear set of requirements and also customize it appropriately so it fits with your organization. So when we've done this with a number of organizational horizon management, is to say, and this is where documenting the requirements before getting bought into a user interface is really important. So we've helped a number of clients document their requirements really clearly and then work them through. So which type of jurisdictions do they operate in? What type of rule sets should they be in terms of licenses, products, client space, customers, product applicability, rules applicability, et cetera, multiple kind of viewpoints, and then document that really clearly so that whichever regulatory horizon management tool is then selected actually picks up the right regulations in the right way. And that's kind of fundamental to that. The other part is then actually customizing that, as I said, customizing that and then linking that through with clear instructions, documentation, training, and the right type of people to be able to interpret and understand the type of rules that are coming through, but and also important for them to be impact assess and respond. So in terms of the human intervention, the compliance, legal, etc., individuals working with the business to then say, right, we've horizon managed it. We have a regulatory library and a regulatory universe. We now have a tool that can sprout out new regulations that are coming through and guidance notices and consulting papers or whatever it might be. Now, what do we do? So you move people from just scanning, from horizon scanning to horizon management and impact assessment is to impact assess the change. And then how do you work up the strategic response? And that's how we've been helping a number of organizations get on top of the vast regulations that are coming through.
Thank you, Nimish. Alan?
Yeah, that's good. That's very good. And I think we're very, very, I mean, how lucky are we now that all of this information is available online, that we're, you know, it's not just done in print anymore. I think there's some kind of serendipity to all of this explosion in regulation coming along with the digital age, or maybe it's because of the digital age. I don't know. But I think to kind of help Naresh and his activities there around understanding, getting this regulatory library in place, you know, built on the fact that it's now all done online and digital first, I think we're seeing a lot of the regulators push forward with not just dumping PDFs on a website anymore, which is certainly still done to a large extent and isn't super helpful. But we're now seeing projects that are really materializing in terms of machine-readable rules and being able to query those rule sets, not just with a web crawler, which isn't always 100% accurate, but with something that can actually go in, read the code, and return a result back saying, you know, from a semantic point of view, I, the machine, understand what this rule is and what it's doing and how it impacts these other rules around here. So I think we're seeing that, you know, it kicked off in the UK back in 2016, 2017. It's now certainly gathering momentum in the US, the Middle East, and APAC as well, which is all good. And I think those of us who are waiting for that to happen are jumping on every opportunity there is to kind of make the most of this. But I don't think we'll get to the point where it will ever be complete. I think it's always going to be a bit of a fourth bridge scenario. We're never quite going to get every single regulation machine readable. So we do need these regulatory libraries, these big kind of reg genome style projects to map all of this stuff, all these taxonomies and all this work that's going on in Finos and the like. This is still valuable work, I think, because we all understand that we're a long way away from it ever, from it being finished, and potentially will it ever be finished? Because there's always going to be a huge chunk of regulation, new sets of regulation coming down the pipe as well, which all needs, as Naresh says, it needs to be managed and implemented properly. So I think the direction of travel is good. I think that the work that Naresh and others are doing is very much along the right lines, and the technology is there. We're sort of ready to go, and we can jump on this and start doing some really nice things with this stuff once we've got really that tipping point of content in the place where we want it to be.
Yeah, and I think Naresh's point about documentation, that's key, right? Before you go into anything, having it documented, having a clear understanding of what you're expecting is crucial, and I agree with you. There's software's all in place, right? You know, Vermic got softwares and stuff like that. But we are a bit down the line. I think there's a lot to do. And we talked about machine readable. So the last question I have for you both, how does the Bank of England transformer data collection change the landscape for firms? What does it mean for them? I know I've spoken to so many firms. I'm like, well, what does it mean? We know, does this mean that we need to, do we just wait, don't buy it, don't buy a software, wait for this to happen and then we're all good? Or do I spend money now and then spend money again? And, you know, how is it going to impact everyone?
Sure. So I was part of the FCM, Bank of England Digital Regulatory Reporting Initiative. I was on the steering committee for 2.5 years when that was in. And you know, Alan mentioned machine executable rules. And so we did a pilot collectively. So I was part of that steering committee. We did a pilot for two different type of rule sets to work to actually evaluate whether it would work in terms of digital regulatory reporting, including machine executable rules, transitions, and then creating those reports in a very digitized fashion, right? And that was the precursor to what then has been recently announced has been announced for the last year and has been underway in terms of transforming data collection by both the FCA and the Bank of England, which I think is a fantastic initiative. And the key thing there, does it actually change the landscape for firms? It absolutely does, because if we think about the different subsectors in financial services, banking, asset management, insurance, and other ancillary type financial services, banking has always been further ahead in terms of data collection, data integration, and governance, purely because of BCBS 239, especially the G-SIBs and the D-SIBs, you know, globally systemically important banks and domestically systematically important banks. It's a bit of a mouthful to say, but G-SIB and D-SIB, I'm trying my best. But so that they... So that has meant banks have had to get better at having data governance and data controls in place anyway. Doesn't necessarily mean that their quality of data has been any good, especially for the larger organizations with 20 million customers and historical legacy infrastructure, but they've had to have this on the road. What transforming data collection has, and I speak to and work with multiple asset managers, multiple insurers, and multiple banks, and we speak about transforming data collection. I also have kind of connections into both the FCA and Bank of England. We talk about what's happening in the industry and what the Bank of England and FCA are trying to achieve. So two perspectives or multiple perspectives. The key is it is going to be better in terms of the transforming data collection will help organizations who need to do regulatory reporting get better organization of their data. So that means less issues in terms of manual interrogation, manual intervention to put those reports together, which all happens across multiple sort of regulatory reporting. That's definitely a benefit for firms to be able to do that and do this under the vehicle, the umbrella of transformative data collection. The second is by improving data end-to-end in terms of the data collection for firms, that's not only a regulatory driver for the financial services firm themselves. That's an important driver for them in terms of customer service, net promoter scores, working out, you know, upsell, cross-sell. So if they can actually use that data more effectively and collect that data and clean up that data, they're going to be in a better place for multiple purposes anyway. So I think that's second. I think the third then is around actually how do you make the end-to-end regulatory ecosystem more efficient? Because we talked at the very upfront of the podcast about the cost of regulation, regulatory change. And by actually having data in a much clearer, much better data quality, much better data controls, much better data governance, and therefore resulting in better data end-to-end, you're really going to get to a point where you reduce the cost across the ecosystem from regulators, regulated institutions, ancillary players, technology firms as a whole. You're actually improving the efficiency and effectiveness of the regulatory ecosystem, which has to be good for the whole full ecosystem.
Thanks, Nirosh. Yeah, I agree. There's a way to go. Alan, I know you were part of this as well on the early infancy.
Yes, I was looking at it from the rules of code angle, and it has kind of evolved now into a kind of data strategy, which is absolutely fine, absolutely no problem with that, particularly given how important that data is to the regulators. So I think, you know, looking at it from my former regulator's hat on, it's very important that the regulator gets the correct data. It gets what it thinks it's asking for, which when you have a manual process isn't always the case. I mean, I remember very vividly an example of a data being submitted to the FCA, and it was a spreadsheet with 3 billion rows of data in it. I mean, how anyone is supposed to do anything with that, I don't know. So if you can ask for the correct data, have it sent to you in a format which you can immediately use it and analyze it and find out, you know, from a supervisory point of view, are the policies that you've put in place working? Are we getting good outcomes for firms and for consumers? This is now a properly grown up environment in which to conduct financial services, rather than the regulator chasing rogue firms for and being fobbed off with data sets that make it look like everything's hunky-dory when really it isn't. And I think that the system is protected from being played like that if we now have a much more automated data digital first strategy, or rather communication path between regulated firm and regulator, so that it's very clear on all sides what needs to be asked for, what needs to be returned, and why the regulator is asking for it that way. So the landscape is evolving, back to your original question, and I think it's becoming a much more grown-up professional, let's say, but a much more data-driven environment in which it's a highly regulated industry, but we can make it, as Nirosh says, we can make it as efficient to participate in that industry as possible, so that we can allow new market participants, we can allow innovation within the industry as well, so everyone isn't kind of tied by these rules and regulations that aren't doing the job that they're supposed to be doing.
Excellent. Seem to cover a lot today. So I do appreciate this, Nirosh and Alan. I think we've managed to go into quite a lot of detail. And for those that haven't read Nirosh's paper, I do recommend it. I know, Nirosh, I'm sure you can tell us where we can get a copy of that. But yeah, I do highly recommend if anyone hasn't read it, do have a read of that. Nirosh, Alan, thank you so much, guys, for your time. I know how busy you are, so I really appreciate you taking time out to do this. I found this useful, so hopefully all my listeners did.
Thank you, Jared. Really enjoyed it. Really enjoyed having the conversation with Alan and yourself. So thank you. Thank you for having me.
No, likewise. I'm sure we'll be doing many more of this in the future, for sure. Thank you for your time, and thank you to our listeners.